In the British Shakespeare Company podcast's eternal quest to interview the most fascinating actors, thespians, artists of our time, I finally get to talk to J.K. Simmons, an actor I am sure you all know, recognize, and or have heard. If you watch cartoons, if you play Portal 2, if you're a fan of classic old HBO shows like Oz, even if you're just one of the several who saw any of the Spider-Man movies, you recognize famed character actor J.K. Simmons. J.K., thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. Thank you. My pleasure.
And I did, I've been doing my research before talking to you, and I was stunned to find out that you are also a famous author. J.K., when did you first create the character Harry Potter?
I did get a review recently in a film that 12 people saw. It might have been the Daily News, where J.K. Rowling was brilliant as the father in this film. And I thought I would trade residuals with her in a heartbeat.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one-third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 238, actor J.K. Simmons. You've had such a cool career. This is what I most envy. Just the variety of your career. From being, a song and dance man on Broadway to playing white supremacists to... Why did you choose to have such a variety of career?
Well, I mean, that always seemed like the goal to me. When I was doing theater for 15 years for hundreds of dollars, that was a big part of the draw. I fell in love with that in college. Studying music and segueing into summer stock, and I just thought the idea of doing something different. Actually, it was not summer stock, it was summer rep, which was even better.
Right.
So literally, you're like the lead in Brigadoon one night, and then you're Shriner number two in Bye Bye Birdie the next night, and that just the variety to me was always a big part of the draw of this ridiculous career. So.
And did you study music or theater in college? Where'd you go to college?
I went to three colleges for my one undergraduate degree. I went to Ohio University and studied pinball, mostly, briefly. I went to Ohio State University, where my dad had taught but had just left the year before.
Go Buckeyes.
Go Bucks, indeed. And, P.S., I'm a weird combination of Detroit Tiger fan and Ohio State Buckeye, because I was... The first 10 years of my life were in Detroit, where my dad taught public school, and then we moved to Columbus, Ohio, where he taught at Ohio State.
That does have to lead to some therapy bills, because you go to the Michigan games wearing a Detroit hat rooting for the Buckeyes.
Yeah, I just leave the Detroit hat at home at the Big Ten games. But I do wear, literally, I often have the Tigers cap and the Ohio State, Block O shirt on the same day, and people don't know what to do with me.
Always leave them befuddled. That's a good motto.
Well, that's what I try to do in my work as well. My third university from which I actually graduated was the University of Montana, where I got a degree in music.
In music. So were you a singer, performer, a composer, instrumentalist?
I was all of the above. I wanted to be Leonard Bernstein when I grew up, was my original plan. I was not an accomplished instrumentalist on anything. My hands don't really connect to my music that way. But I played Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star on every instrument in the orchestra.
Yeah.
I was a composer, a conductor, a singer, and, segue, and, how many years later? 34 years later,
Let's not dwell on the years. Was it an easy transition to theater? Was it just natural? Did you feel like theater was, just an evolution from music? Are they related in your mind, or are they different skills, music and theater, performing?
I think they are related, but they're also very different skills. And I was horrible in my first theatrical endeavors at the Big Fork Summer Playhouse in Big Fork, Montana. Where the first year literally did play the lead in Brigadoon and then a Shriner in Bye Bye Birdie, and I'm not going to remember what else that season, but I was literally the first time, because I had only really done operetta and opera and legitimate quote-unquote music in college, so I literally, the first day of blocking rehearsal, I came out there, and the first line in the show is Tommy and Jeff are lost in the woods, and Tommy says, "Here, let me see that map." okay, all right, there's Alcantul, here's Braymore, so where the hell are we? Unbelievable that I remember that. But I remember because I walked out onto the stage and went, here, let me see that map. Oh. And then the director said, okay, let's take a break. Let's take five. And we sat down and had a lengthy conversation. And basically, for the rest of the summer, I was like Brando in Streetcar, going so, you know, completely off, you know, trying to, it was all so, you know.
When I'm on there, the girl that I fancy the girl.
Is that Phineas Rainbow?
I get Rainbow. Damn. Which we did 2 years later. With my little brother, actually.
So when you graduated, did you go immediately to New York? Was that the thing? Was that the plan?
I never had any intention of ending up in New York or L.A. When I graduated, just for lack of anything else to do, I headed out to see. I took a little trip down the West Coast and visited friends in Seattle and Oregon and California, northern and southern, and drove back through Vegas and made enough money to buy gas to get back to Montana, and then I just decided to move to Seattle because it was sort of the closest, you know, medium-sized city, and I thought, you know, if I can go there and sort of do something to survive 9 months a year and go do summer stock in Montana the rest of my life, I'll be happy.
And Seattle's a great theater town.
Yeah, and especially at that time, it was a good town for, you know, some schmuck from Montana to show up and you know, be able to get a gig here and there. And then I did one non-equity show or two, and then got my equity card at the Seattle Rep. Either the first or second year I was there, and yeah, I was in Seattle for 5 years before I moved to New York.
At what point did the move to New York seem inevitable, or did you get a gig?
Well, I did when I was in Seattle. I did a gig in Sun Valley, Idaho, a musical called Cowboy that was written by a guy from Montana, you know, back home connection. Really a nice piece, and I played the lead character, Charlie Russell, who is a great Western artist, under-recognized Western artist, better than Frederick Remington.
So there.
And a really nice little piece, and you know, the creators were from New York, and they had all these, you know, big plans to, you know, have it be the next giant hit Broadway musical. And so that fall, I, you know, a number of things conspired in my personal and professional life that, you know, it seemed I didn't have anything to lose. I went to New York, and of course that musical never went anywhere. But, you know, there I was living in a hellhole in Hell's Kitchen and alternately camping with my aunt and uncle up in Scarsdale when I needed a little creature comfort. And, you know, starved and waited tables for a year and then started getting some theater work.
Well, and like so many actors, particularly the ones just starting out, but also everyone just looking for a gig, you actors in New York can spend a lot of time leaving New York in the summertime. And that's where we met. It was up at Milford, New Hampshire, in the American Stage Festival. Was that a typical thing for you? Would you, you know, spend all summer at different theaters?
Yeah, you know, that may have been the only actual, like, summer gig that I had out of it. I was doing regional theater all the time out of New York, but I never got, other than my old non-equity theater in Montana, I never had a regular summer stock place that I went to. I had, you know, I was working at, you know, the Arena Stage in Buffalo or the Huntington in Boston or, you know, I mean, all over the place, Atlanta, Minneapolis, blah, blah, blah. Back in Seattle, actually, now that I was a New York actor, I got better parts at the Seattle Rep. the American Theater Festival.
American Stage Festival
American
in
Stage
Milford.
Festival. Yeah. In Milford was, it was just on that same sort of circuit, this, you know, the same two or three or four casting directors in New York that were always hiring me. And again, you know, I was lucky enough to have guys that were willing to not always cast me as the same type of thing. I would do a musical, then I would go do a Shakespeare play, then I would go do a new play, or, you know.
Well, and that, you know, it's funny to have met you on Peg of My Heart, the musical, because I think, if memory serves, you were the neighbor who sort of bounded over and said, tennis, anyone?
Yes. I was the cad from down the lane who was seducing the sort of innocent daughter. The title song was sung by Davis Gaines, who was brilliant, you know, one of the great Broadway singers.
Ann Morrison was Peg, and it was
Ann Morrison was Peg. Jeff Brooks and Joel Blum were in the cast, who have been, you know, lifelong friends. And
well, and I think of you know, I think of Humphrey Bogart, when they write the biography of Humphrey Bogart, they always talk about his early ingenue days when he played the Tennis Anyone character. And, you know, certainly the Tennis Anyone bounder cad from down the lane is not, are not really the roles we now know you for. We know you as either a tough guy or a down-to-earth, you know, blue-collar guy who also plays detectives and who also plays court psychologists and white supremacists. You have found casting directors and directors who are willing to kind of look at all kind of facets of it.
Yeah, and, you know, it's sort of a self-fulfilling thing after a certain point, you know.
They know you can do it all.
Right, and once you've done, you know, enough different things, you know, then once you've been given those opportunities, and a couple of them end up being fairly high profile, which is obviously just the luck of the draw, then that continues to feed off itself.
And you were in that revival of Guys and Dolls that was very well received with Nathan Lane and Peter Gallagher, and you and Walter Bobby. Walter Bobby also played up at the American Stage Festival. You got that great trio, the Fugue for Tin Horns.
Walter Bobby and Tim Hsu and myself, and Faith Prince, of course, was in that as well,
right,
as Adelaide.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that was Jerry Zaks, the director. That was my, I had done a workshop with Jerry of a new thing a year or two before that. That was huge and really gigantic in a lot of people's careers. You know, sort of got Walter back to Broadway because he'd been a soap guy for a few years after that, which is, you know, I mean, not a bad life, but now all of a sudden he's Walter Bobby Broadway director guy.
And, Mr. Big Shot.
Right?
Yeah.
It certainly launched, you know, Nathan and Faith and a lot of us. You know, I mean, that was when we opened and the review was on the front page of the New York Times, and the line was, you know, we set box office records. All of a sudden, everybody in the cast was getting calls from commercial agents and this and that, and that was when I first finally got a voiceover agent and started having a little income, you know, besides my weekly theater paycheck that ended, you know, the week the show closed.
Well, and you talk about directors willing to look at different facets of you, and you were getting established as this Walter Bobby's a soap guy, but we bring him back to theater, and you're a musical theater guy, and then you get to play this really badass character on Oz, white supremacist leader of the gang within the prison. Did then people not want to see you as anything else after that? Did they only see you as badass tough guys?
Well, that was my fear going in, and I had just started doing some TV guest spots and I think maybe one or two tiny roles in films before Oz, and when I met with Tom Fontana, one of the great guys, we were meeting, and they didn't even have scripts really. They had sort of outlines, and they had some of the Augustus Hill monologues, the Harold Perrineau character in the wheelchair, and they were just meeting and reading, and I had done one of my two big TV guest spots that I had done before that was on Homicide, Tom's show, as a, you know, neo-Nazi, you know, paramilitary bastard white supremacist guy, and so he thought of me for this part. We were meeting, we were talking about it, and even though I was, you know, this theater actor from hunger. I mean, I was, you know, I told my agent, no more Broadway. I gotta, you know, make a segue here. I almost talked my way out of the job because I did have that fear of, this is the first thing that millions of people are going to see me do. And, you know, if it's this, then I don't want to be stuck playing the bad guy of the week the rest of my career, you know. I want to be able to be as versatile as I have been in theater these, you know, 15 or 20 years. So Tom kept reassuring me, oh, you know, this character, it's going to really, you know, we don't have scripts yet, but we're, you know, this character's going to, at first we're going to think he's this sort of befriending our everyman character, our protagonist, and it's going to be down the road, he's going to really have a journey, and then we're going to find out what a sick bastard he is and what a nasty guy he is. And that journey ended up taking like 8 minutes of the first episode before I was tattooing my cellmate's ass. But then the incredibly good stroke of fortune that happened after that, not only was Oz, you know, a big critical hit, and a really, really, more importantly, a great thing to be a part of. But the next fall, you know, a month after we finished Oz, I got a call to do Law and Order, and out of the blue, and I had auditioned for a different part, and they wanted me to play the recurring shrink on Law and Order. So I was the psycho and the psychiatrist, and you know, and a lot of people were seeing both.
Yeah.
And it was the perfect balance at that time so that I didn't start getting pigeonholed.
Hey everybody, it's Arch Campbell from ABC 7 and News Channel 8, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Theater Company podcast. Oh my God.
Where can you RSC the RSC? For the next 4 weeks until July 24th, 2011, we'll be in Washington, D.C. at the Kennedy Center, the balcony of which I am standing on overlooking the Potomac River to record this between the matinee and the evening performance. We'll be performing completely Hollywood Abridged for one more week, and then we'll be performing 3 weeks of The Complete World of Sports Abridged. You can also see us briefly and hear us online giving an audio tour of publicly owned Shakespeare paintings. Go to bbc.co.uk/arts/your paintings and click on Choose Your Tour Guide. There you will find links to such art experts as Frank Skinner, Rory Bremner, and of course, the Reduced Shakespeare Company. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office venue and ticket information.
Then you got, not then you got, eventually you got the sort of this character actor dream role of J. Jonah Jameson in the Spider-Man movies. What was the audition like for that? How stylized, how big did you know you wanted to go or wanted them to, them want, they wanted you to be?
Unfortunately, you can actually find out on the DVD, I think, because I was foolish enough to let them, you know, use my audition tape. I think we all, or several of us at least, signed off on, sure, you can put the audition tape. I had done two movies with Sam Raimi before that, For Love of the Game and The Gift. And when we were shooting The Gift was when word got out that Sam was going to be the Spider-Man director. And I've never particularly been very good at having my ear to the ground with knowing what's going on in showbiz, which is why I'm glad I have a good agent. God knows I don't do any work. But friends started calling me and saying, "Oh man, you gotta talk to Sam. You should play the bad guy. You know, you should play." And then they kept naming all the bald bad guys that, you know, right, the Vulture and Doc Ock, and nobody knew what the script was. Right.
Lex Luthor's. Oh no, sorry, wrong universe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Wrong comic book chain. And you know, I mean, I'm not gonna go in the middle of, you know, playing the Southern sheriff. You know, hey Sam, how about that Spider-Man thing? You know.
Yeah.
But when they were casting Spider-Man, it turns out Sam had always had me in mind to play JJJ. But, you know, he was in a position where I still had to go audition for the producers. And as I recall, one of the scenes I auditioned with was the scene where the Green Goblin bursts into my office and, you know, lifts me by the throat and is choking me and trying to get me to give up Spider-Man, and I don't. And, you know, the one scene that sort of shows, oh, this guy's not a complete jerk. Yeah. You know, he's risking his life to save some guy he doesn't like, you know, whatever. But it's a ridiculous scene to audition with,
right,
you know, because
right,
I'm being choked, and I'm holding the sides, you know.
Right.
I mean, I literally almost never have I memorized an audition, because my theory has always been that I think they're looking at a finished product.
Yeah.
If it's memorized, then to me it's an audition, and also I'm just lazy.
Let that be a lesson to you, kids.
Yeah, all you kids, just be lazy, and it'll work out fine. But obviously, you know, it was enough to, you know, to sell the producers. And Sam and I had just always been on the same page. I felt like I was not a big comic book guy as a kid, but one of my cousins was, and he was a huge Spider-Man fan. And whenever we were hanging out, I always thought, along with Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos,
yep,
that Spider-Man was, you know, the coolest. And JJJ just seemed to both Sam and me like the character that most needed to jump straight from the comic book pages onto the screen and could afford to be, you know, big and brassy and broad, and the other characters, you know, might need to be a little more naturalistic. And you know, the look of the character sort of, you know, was pretty clear, you
yeah
know. You got to do the haircut, you got to do the mustache. I ended up doing false prosthetic teeth as well, because my memory of the comics, and I researched, you know, I read all the comics again. Marvel was nice enough to help us out. You know, he's always got that, you know, teeth bared, you know.
And a cigar chomp.
And the cigar, yeah, we had to do the cigar.
Yeah.
You know? So really, I mean, yeah, the look of it was obviously nothing that we created. We were just trying to recreate it the best we could. And I did have a guy several months after it came out at a voiceover audition. This was when we were back in New York. A guy came up to me and you know, complimented me on the movies and said, yeah, man, he said, it's just, you're absolutely spot on, perfect impression of the voice from the TV series, the animated series.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, shit, I never saw that.
Yeah.
And I'm really bummed out that it sounds exactly like what someone... And I still haven't seen it, so I still have no idea.
That's so funny.
If I was, you know, if I sounded exactly like, you know, what somebody else had done.
I thought he was going to say, you're the spot on exactly like the voice that comes out of the pages of the comic book. Like, the voice in that guy's head.
Yeah. No. Yeah. No. It was just, he was just complimenting me for being a good ripoff.
Well, listen, steal from the best. You know, and then a lot of people, I think, know you as Juno's father in Juno, which could not be a more different, more performance naturalistic. Is it as easy to distinguish the two as saying Juno's a film performance and Spider-Man was like a musical theater performance, or in terms of size, or how do you make those distinctions when you're judging how big your performance to get?
You know, I really just try to read the script and do what I think it says, and then you know, collaborate with hopefully a really smart director, and you know, Sam Raimi, Jason Reitman, certainly, you know, the Coen brothers. I mean, I've been really lucky in that regard. To me, you know, the script, and you know, it's not like I automatically connect with everything I read, and obviously, like everybody else, I don't get every job that I'm up for or that I audition for, and sometimes I read something and I can get it intellectually, but I can also know I'm not going to be that good in it. You know, it just doesn't fit.
Right.
And I'm learning still at my advanced age. You know, you don't have to go in for those. I mean, even if it's something that's good that you admire, if it's not something that you think, you know, you can be. You can do justice, you know. I, this sounds, you know, disingenuous, but I always, from my college days as a singer, singing Brahms and Beethoven, I've always believed in the Shakespeare, you know, the play's the thing. And when I was a singer, I wasn't one of those guys who, you know, sort of reveled in the glory of his own voice. You know, I was really just trying to interpret the brilliance of Brahms, you know, or whoever. And you know, even, I mean, you look at Spider-Man and you say, this guy's chewing the scenery. But even that role, to me, I was really just trying to do, you know, what they wrote 40 years ago and what they wrote for the movie and what Sam wanted me to do. And when you're doing, you know, Juno, something, very different stylistically, that's, you know, I read that script and thank God Jason went to bat for me, because they were, you know, the money people wanted lots of big movie star names in that part, as well as Ellen's part and a lot of the parts that ended up being breakouts, you know, for people.
Right.
And I digress again, I just read it and go with my instincts and then collaborate.
Do you? I mean, you have kids now. Is any part of the gigs that you take now for your kids, because it'll be cool in their eyes? My son just you know, when he met you, he went, wait, that's J.J. Jameson, right? Yeah. He said, okay, very good, very cool. But then he heard you on Portal 2, boy, and he's just like, J.K. Simmons on Portal 2, that's awesome. Do you get any of that at home from the?
No. The Portal 2 thing has been huge with the game, and I literally. My son was trying to teach me the very basics on the Xbox, and I'm just hopeless, and I'm an old dog, and I will not learn that new trick.
You know, me too.
Angry Birds is as far as I can. But I'm not even sure what the question was.
Do you do stuff for your kids?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Most of the stuff that I was doing early on, when Joe was born, my oldest was born actually during For Love of the Game in '98. I hadn't really done any, you know, kid-friendly stuff. I did one episode of a wacky Nickelodeon live-action show years ago in New York called The Adventures of Pete and Pete. where I played Barber Dan. And that was like the only kid-friendly thing I did for years because I was doing Oz and,
right.
you know, Law and Order, which is, you know, not particularly graphic, but it's not, you know, for right. kids. I never got a chance to do like a, you know, Sesame Street, you know, or any of those things when my kids were really little. Since we moved to L.A., I've been picking up more and more animated stuff. But even the animated stuff is, a lot of it has been more, you know, a spot on The Simpsons or American Dad or... a show called Generator Rex that I do that's actually sort of in my 12-year-old's wheelhouse now.
And you're in animation voiceovers, you're in feature films, you're a regular on The Closer on TNT. You're in commercials. Are there any gigs you won't take?
Oh, I used to drive my agent crazy with what I wouldn't take, you know, because for since early on in the Oz days, since like, I don't know, 98, 99, I got the sweetest job I've ever had, which is playing the voice of the yellow M&M. And that has been really my screw you money for, you know, 12, 13, 14 years. Billy West and I, he's the red M&M, I'm the yellow M&M. And, you know, they pay us a ridiculous amount of money to be these characters and have fun and be, you know, sort of anonymous.
Yeah.
And so I was... from the day that started, I thought, this is great, because now I can really only do stuff I want to do, you know? And there's certainly, I haven't always made brilliant choices, and there are some things I look back on and I wish I hadn't done, but I've been just extraordinarily blessed to be in the position of not having to take every job that goes along. And the main thing for me now is that means I don't have to go out of town.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I do sometimes, but, you know, it was a thing we were talking about years ago that my, you know, I went in and met on and blah, 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 and it was a fascinating project. And then at the end of the meeting, you know, when the director and I were really seeing eye to eye and having a great time, I find out it's going to shoot for, you know, 12 weeks in India and Pakistan. And I just, you know, my kids are whatever, you know, 4 and, you know, 6 or 7 at the time. I mean, you know, I if I had that, you know, opportunity when I was single, you know, I would have jumped all over it. But but now my priorities are different, as they get to be when, you know, you're doing the dad thing. And I'm able to, you know, within reason. I mean, I go out of town very little. That was a big part of why we moved to L.A. 8 years ago when Oz ended, was that it seemed like this was the best chance to have a regular job and be able to be at home. And The Closer has been perfect in that regard, because it's been, you know, a good show. It's well written. It's well acted. It's something I'm proud to be a part of. But it's also very part time, you know, for me. I'm not working the Kira Sedgwick hours, and I'm coaching my kids' little league teams, and I'm seeing my wife and kids, you know, pretty much every day.
And as you were saying earlier, you get to have some sort of little nudge into the writing process, into your character's journey, you know. So that's got to be a little bit fun.
Yeah, and that's always been fun for me too, because God knows I'm not a writer. I have no interest in writing, directing, producing. I've always just liked being a hired gun, because I'm lazy. There it is again. I'm not a self motivator.
There's a theme in your work.
Yes, indeed it is. He's so lazy. You know, as you work with different directors in film and television, you know, you some of them are very collaborative and expect you and want you to, you know, ad lib, you know, bring your own ideas and this. And then some of them are very, you know, the Coen brothers, very specific. And I mean, every comma, everything, you know, is exactly as they have very thoroughly thought it out. And that's exactly what they want. And both can be, you know, like Sam Raimi with the Spider-Man movies, you know, we made up, you know, probably a third of what you see on screen in the office scenes is stuff that, you know, we either sort of came up with, you know, a day or two beforehand, or just did on the day with me and Toby and Liz and Sam's brother Ted, and you know, it's almost like, you know, Night at the Improv, and both, you know, both processes are great, and it's great to be able to go back and forth. And actually, James Duff, our head writer on The Closer, has been, not that we're like improvising, you know, on that show, but from the beginning, he's allowed me to have a, you know, a pretty nice amount of freedom and just sort of making the dialogue my own. You know, once in a while, the script supervisor comes over and says, you know, you're kind of missing the point here. You know, but generally, I have a nice amount of freedom on that show, which is you know, cool. And unless you're working on a show like you know, a Friday Night Lights or a show that's you know, designed that way, where it's right. basically just an outline. Usually on a scripted drama, you don't have that kind of freedom, which has been nice.
Well, and on the David Kelly shows, you know, David underlines words for a reason, so you need to hit that word.
I haven't done the David Kelly.
I got those gigs on the David Kelly show because I think I could say the words like exculpatory and semen without giggling.
But see, I can't. There I go.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your screw you money via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on our website podcast page, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans at our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter @Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks as always to webmaster Matt Rippey, Peter Parker, Jimmy Olsen, wannabe Matthew Croak. Music by John Weber and Garage Band. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Brian J. Patterson. No reason. It is just random. Special thanks to DC Institution Arch Campbell. We'll be on Arch's TV show later this week. And thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 238 714ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Didn't you want to play Harold Hill?
I did play Harold Hill. That was my triumphant return home to Missoula, Montana.
As I'm sure you probably know, because I think it's all over the internet, you know, I was the definitive 12th grade Harold Hill at my high school. So what do you think? Should we try to do a treble off?
I'm sure.
Well, you got trouble, my friends.
Right here in Riverside.
Right here. I say trouble right here. Well, sure, I'm a billiard player. Certainly mighty proud to say I'm always mighty proud of it.
Consider the hours I spent in the pool hall at Golden. Yeah. Helped cultivate horse sense and a cool head and a keen eye. Did you ever take a try and give an ironclad leave to yourself from a three-rail billiard shot? And I'm done.
Nice.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less. So much less. So much less.